are listening to WWBC Coco, Merritt Island, 1510 AM, as well as W234BI Coco, Rockledge, 94.7 FM, W264AS, Rockledge, Melbourne, Palm Bay, Indian Atlantic, Indian Harbor Beach, Satellite Beach, 100.7 FM, and W260CL, Coco, 99.9 FM.
And Treasure Coast. This is Sita Begee on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends right here in sunny, today's sunny Coco, Florida. We are here on AM 1510. We're on FM 94.7, FM 99.9, and FM 100.7. All our shows can be heard on the web. Ellen, you can tell our listeners how to listen to our show today.
Well, you can tune in. Hopefully, if you're listening live, you already know this. You can go into 1510wwbc.com, and you'll be able to hit the on-demand button and find us there, listen live. Or if you'd like a replay of the show, if you're not able to listen for the full hour, you can certainly go to our website, cdmediainc.com, and hit the on-demand button there as well. And
that's right.
Get the shows. Yeah.
So for our listeners who are just tuning into Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, Ellen Little and myself, we sit here every Monday in the studio for an hour, thanks to our great sponsors. And we speak about things that are going on around the nation, right here in Brevard County. And we heat up the airways. We try to be the change we wish to see in this world.
That's right.
We try to find purpose, and we found our purpose through a voice. And we thank Paul and WWBC for giving us this opportunity to be responsible with our voice and have quality shows and great guests that call in to speak about homelessness, drug abuse,
all over the world,
education, the Indian River Lagoon, what's happening with child abuse, human trafficking. We speak with politicians who want to make a difference in our community. We speak with priests. We speak with people. But we do understand that our views doesn't match up with everybody else's views all the time. But we try. We try.
Absolutely. Well, at least we try and provide an education, right?
Right.
That's what we've always said about the show.
Right.
It's unscripted, educational, and hopefully we have a little bit of fun while we're doing it.
We do.
Learn a little bit about somebody else's perspective.
Right. And it's nice to see people who come into the studio and ask us to come back. They want to be return guests. So today, one of such guests, of course, we want to say that we're watching what's going on all over the country with the protesting here in London and everywhere. And we want to say on behalf of our show, we support the protesters and what they want. They want to change the past, what has happened. We want to make the wrongs of the past right. We want to end systemic racism through systemic changes. People should vote. They should communicate with each other and try to be thy brother's keeper for real in thought, words and action. And that's from a Hindu girl. I'm Christian stuff.
So
but
sweet.
Today we have Ellen, a wonderful guest that I met through a friend. Kevin Daniel Bihar set up this guest for us, and his name is
Dr. Josh.
Is it Pryor? And he's on the phone. Yes. And Josh Pryor is here. He's a master and doctor of education, and he's in partnership with the education lead at Prodigy. And as you know, so many people have had to go to online learning because of COVID-19.
Yes.
And I reached out to Kevin and I asked him if he can help. And he recommended Dr. Josh Pryor. So thank you for calling in to Viewpoint with Sita and Friends to a fun, unscripted, unedited educational show.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. And tell our listeners here, Dr. Josh Pryor, where are you calling from?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be happy to. So by trade, I'm an educator. I was a teacher and an administrator in South Florida in Palm Beach County. But I've made my way up to Canada to join an education technology company, like you said, called Prodigy.
Yeah, you know what? We all watch. I know for a while there, everybody was on YouTube watching the videos with the, I think it called the can, was it a fella in India or Pakistan, one of those places, the Khan Academy. And I always wondered, wow, how did this guy get so intelligent to put these videos on so people could watch children learning in India under a tree, sitting in the hot sun. And now I find out that there's so many technological companies using technology to teach and help our children. So tell our listeners on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends, what are the benefits to online education and distance learning?
Sure. So when we think about distance learning, we think about, obviously, we need to leverage that technology. And we know that technology can help augment teachers, but it's never going to replace teachers. So when I think about the benefits of online education, I think about, you know, of course, the different stakeholders, right? You've got students and you've got teachers. So in many cases, some students learn better virtually than they do in person. Of course, engagement is absolutely critical in that regard, right? As students are at home, we've got to get them engaged in their learning material. And so that's, I think, why we've seen a huge spike in students playing our game, because they love learning and they love games, right?
Yes.
Another benefit that I think of is students learning life skills, but self-discipline, time management, things like that. Those are major benefits for students.
So, you know, of course, we're watching that here in Brevard County, Florida, where we reside. My grandchildren had to do their classes online, and the teachers got on and did it everything right, and they passed their exams, and they're doing well. But what do you say to parents who can't afford a computer, maybe don't have internet services? Do you feel like those children are at a disadvantage to the ones that parents can afford to stay home and assist them with online learning and can afford to have a computer, pay for services? Is there a drawback to children that fall in that category or adults?
So what I think is, I still keep in really, really close communication with the principals in South Florida who I worked with. And it's really important that everybody knows those administrators are working so hard to help bridge that gap. So among other things, what they do is have printed resources available for parents to pick up for their students to do. That would also include, a lot of times, devices. I know one principal passed out over 800 devices, and that's at a school that's a Title I school, meaning that they need extra support because the population of the students and families are often economically disadvantaged. So what we've seen is school building leaders really leaning on each other. So when this particular principal ran out of Chromebooks to pass out, she started reaching out to other schools in the network that she knew would have extras, and thus was able to get those out to those families. So it's really about putting our heads together to think about how we can best serve, you know, all students and all families.
So we just want to tell our listeners who we're speaking with Dr. Josh Prior. You know, your name is spelled P-R-I-E-U-R, but it's Prior, mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah,
I'm
That's
saying
right.
it. Yeah, like
That's
Richard right. Prior, right? Except Richard Prior
exactly.
Spells his differently. and you are calling us from Canada, and you are with the company called Prodigy. And it's interesting that you left the United States and went to Canada, and now you're able to call in on our show and spread your knowledge and give us some of your wisdom when it comes to this kind of learning. And I know Ellen has a question for you as well.
Well, first I wanted to ask, is it prodigytechnologies.com? Is that the website?
We're prodigygame.com.
Prodigygame.com. Okay, so make sure all of our listeners know that so that you can actually go online and check out the website. Because I did get to the prodigygame.com website. I just thought,
and he's right. A lot of kids are playing those games, and online learning is huge right now.
Yeah.
But for everything,
and the engagement part of it is really cool with the gaming part. Right. So, what are some of the challenges that are being faced by students, parents, teachers, and administrators? I mean, other than the fact that they might not have a computer, so it seems like some of those folks are coming up with some alternatives. But what are some of the other challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. There's that's a lot of stakeholders to think about. So, okay, so let's break that down a little bit. So students, when we think about the challenges they face, you know, their routines were broken because of this pandemic. They're not getting to see their friends as much, maybe not fully comprehending why this is all happening. So in addition, when we think about especially older students, a lot of them have jobs and they're working to help support the family, or they might be helping to take care of the siblings in the house so parents can continue to work. So, you know, it's a major challenge for them that they, you know, need to overcome, and they need all kinds of support to do that. And so in that regard, I know teachers are working so hard to make sure that they're doing anything they can to support them. When I think about parents, a lot of times, you know, it's a best case scenario that they're still working through all of this. They're taking care of their kids full time, right, with daycares being closed. And then you've got to add in that layer of teaching on top of everything. So it becomes hard to balance. And I've got three kids of my own at home that I try and balance with my wife and make sure they're taken care of. And
boy, the pressure was on you, huh?
Not the simplest.
Yeah, well, I think the teachers would be so much more appreciated when the kids go back to school, because parents are now having to discipline, teach, cook, clean, and watchman those kids.
Right. You're absolutely right. I couldn't agree more. And then when I think about challenges that teachers face, they've lost that face-to-face, that in-person contact piece, right, where they're constantly reading the room. They lose those teachable moments, right, that you really want to seize and help your class kind of learn and grow. So it makes it much, much harder to be that coach and that cheerleader that students need as they're learning and growing from you.
So how are teachers going above and beyond during this mean COVID-19? I mean, right now, I'm a nurse, and I know that we in the nursing profession, we have to go above and beyond for our patients or residents, because their loved ones can't come in and give them a hug. They've got to watch them through the windows, or thank God for technology such as Prodigy Games, they can FaceTime with them. And so we have to be a little bit more extra careful. We have to give a lot of love and support, and the responsibility is huge for us in the nursing profession. I would imagine that the teachers have to go above and beyond as well.
Absolutely. So I know teachers are doing so much, and of course you read about it in the news all the time. They're working incredible hours trying to make sure that they're balancing the students' academic needs, whether it's teaching lessons or grading work or things like that. But a lot of times they're also offering that emotional support, whether it's the teacher helping the student independently or helping connect them with a guidance counselor. You've got that piece where they've got to really stay connected. And I think that's shown, like, the way that teachers go and do that. Like, my cousin Christina in New York, she's a music teacher, and she didn't get the chance to sort of say goodbye to her seniors. So she and her husband went to the home of every single senior so she could sing them a song to help give them closure and congratulate them.
I like her already. We need to get Christina to call in on our show. Well, you know, my even like we had during this COVID-19 pandemic, we had our residents' families. We did a drive-through where we got them into their wheelchairs and we dressed them up, and their families drove through the driveway of our facility with the most beautiful cards and words of encouragement and I love you, Nana, and things like that. And people have gotten so creative, even for birthday parties, too. They're driving through neighborhoods with balloons. And we have to be. Otherwise, I mean, unfortunately, the human connection is lost right now. And so it's very important for you and your team at Prodigy Games to do what you're doing to keep all of us entwined with each other.
Right. And I wanted to mention to all the listeners, if you go to prodigygame.com, you'll see that it's actually a free, right? It's a free service. I'm not sure if once you get into it, how far you get into it, if you have to start to pay. But it seems like it's a great resource that everybody should be checking into.
Yeah.
That's right. It's completely no cost. Students have access to the resource if they have the internet and a device. We want to make sure everybody has access to the world-class education content that we have.
That's amazing, and such a fantastic option for folks. So what are some tips that you can provide parents to help engage their students or engage their kids in learning math and education without falling too far behind?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things that parents can do as I think about it. I think the first one that comes to mind is definitely keeping students on a schedule. Maybe they're at home, but if we can mentally get them to think about, you know, being at school and following sort of a plan during the day, that's going to help keep them on track.
Right, like not doing schoolwork in pajamas, right?
Yeah. I think adults need to have a schedule too, because, you know, I remember once asking my children to come outside and help rake some leaves. And I could not get my two sons and my two daughters outside at all. And I went to work, and I was telling that story to a patient who's 100 years old. And she looked me right in the eye, and she said, "Nurse, you know what's the best way to get children to do chores?" And I said, "What?" And she said, "You do it with them. You lead by example. Don't tell them to do it." She says, "You go outside and you grab that rake and that bag, and they'll come out." And sure enough, I tried that approach, and it worked. So I do think that sometimes the parents have to get involved.
That's right.
Right.
So what are some other tips that you have there, Dr. Josh?
Yeah, so I would say definitely staying in constant contact with your child's teacher is critical. There's going to be a lot going on both ends. You know, don't be afraid to ask them for help if something's unclear. They want to make sure that they're helping support you, support your children. Helping them stay organized, whether it's with an agenda or a to-do list or things like that. And then the other thing that I would say is try and think outside the box. This is really an opportunity where, you know, digital game-based learning is flourishing. It's an area that students love coming to because they love to play games. And so tools and resources like Prodigy that get students excited for the game element helps them to build that love of learning as well, even while they're playing and having fun.
Well, you know, my son is an engineer, and he's been working on making some sort of a game. So I'm going to have to send him your way to see what's going on with Prodigy Games. I'm going to have to tell him about the company to go on the website and check it out. So what are some of the aspects of Prodigy education that helps increase learning and engagement with online learning?
So what I would say number one is engagement. We help students really get into and love the game that they're playing. Math gets presented in a fun and interactive way. And that's something that is a topic that doesn't always come easy to students, right? I think of myself as an early learner. I was not what you would call a math person. I had anxiety and frustration, and I would sometimes say that I became an English teacher for a reason, and I want to see that change. And that's part of what Prodigy does, right? We use and leverage technology to help students get, you know, remediation when they need it, if they're not quite understanding something, but also enrichment if they're able to move on to the next level. We want to help really serve the students where they're at. And so that's, in terms of the student, how we sort of help them. And then beyond that, you think of the other layers of stakeholders that exist, right? For teachers, the platform's really easy to use. They know they're getting standards-aligned material to the students. They're getting data on the back end. For parents, they get report cards. Prodigy works on any device. It's based on HTML5, which is not an accident. We want to make sure that even if you have low bandwidth internet, you can get onto our platform. And then in terms of administrators, they also get school or district-wide visibility into how students are doing, so they can really think about how to close those gaps through a research-based platform.
Right, and no question is a stupid question, right? Because there's so many people that are technologically challenged.
Yes.
So you would encourage those people not to be afraid. Don't be afraid of technology. Embrace it, right? How do you tell somebody that who's like scared to death, like my husband?
Who's barely passed an email.
Yeah.
Well, that's been one of the bright spots in this whole thing is, like, you know, again, keeping communication with my peers is that the teachers who are really, really tech savvy are helping work with those who haven't developed those skills yet. And it's really kind of brought them together, which has been really, really interesting.
Right. And so how did you find such a dream job? You sound like really, really happy. You sound like you love what you're doing. And we appreciate the fact that you're teaching us and lending your voice to our show and helping us to understand online learning and distance learning. How did you find such a great job?
Yeah, so as I thought about my career, I knew I always wanted to be in education, and I went to be a teacher, and I was super proud to become a teacher, and I thought about going into administration, so I went back to school for that and managed to become an assistant principal, which was absolutely wonderful, but I thought even more about wanting to have a really big splash on the world. And so when I thought about Prodigy, it was really their mission that roped me in. And it was the idea that no matter who you are, no matter where you are, you get access to a world-class education tool at no cost whatsoever, right? So as Prodigy built their business model, you can do it one of a couple of ways. you can have students, school districts paying for a license for students, which can get costly, and it's exclusionary, right? If a district can't pay for your tool, you don't get access to it. And so as an educator and as a person, it was Prodigy's mission that really roped me in and made me think, like, wow, we can really make a difference and help students no matter where they are, regardless of socioeconomic status, have access to a world-class tool. And so I actually cold messaged the CEO on LinkedIn and while I was in Florida and said, hey, I really love what you're doing. I'm interested. Can we have a discussion? And it all kind of rolled from there.
Well, thank you. You are encouraging us to think outside the box. And also, you know, a lot of us lump words together when we say we want to give opportunities for all, but you're actually doing it. You are giving that opportunities to every single student, no matter where they come from, or what they look like, or what their socioeconomic standing is in life. All they have to do is log on, correct?
That's right, 100% correct. And that was what moved my wife and I to move 1,500 miles from Florida to Toronto.
It's very exciting and such a great, once again, kind of like a path, a vision of what learning could be in the future. So what a great prodigygames.com, everyone. If you're listening, make sure you check that out, all free. And thank you, Dr. Josh Pryor, for joining us today and to give us some insight about Prodigy, and we'll certainly get the word out.
Yeah, we'd love for you to call in again and update us with what more stuff about Prodigy Games, because I think that there are a lot of parents that actually enjoyed having the children at home and enjoyed teaching their kids and watching them learn and grow and be creative, and they want to continue online schooling and homeschooling.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again, Dr. Josh Pryor,
for tuning in. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling in. And Sita, we're going to take a quick station break because we have another caller right after this guest.
Yes. Portions of Viewpoint with Sita and Friends is sponsored by the friends and family of Sita Begee, author of 18 Brothers and Sisters, and founder of Simply Sita Skincare, and these great sponsors. Jotkoff Financial Group is a certified public accounting and a registered investment advisory firm with over 30 years of productive relationships with clients. Jotkoff Financial Group can assist you in meeting your accounting, tax, and business consulting and financial planning and insurance needs without expanding your internal workforce. With three locations here in Florida, here in Brevard County, Broward County, and Nassau County. Contact Jotkoff Financial Group here in Brevard at 321-984-7345. Located at 1122 South Wickham Road in Melbourne, that's Jotkoff Financial Group. On the web, you'll find them at www.jotkoff, that's JOTKOFF.com. Call the professionals at Jotkoff Financial Group today.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We just took a quick break before we get right into the groove of things here. Our good friend of the show, Ellen, Jennifer Carroll, is on the phone, and she's going to be joining us with our conversations today about what's going on around the United States and around the world, about protesting, why people should protest but not be violent. Well, she disagrees with the looting, and we all do. But before we do that, Jennifer, we're going to say welcome to our show and tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, all the wonderful things you've done in your career. Just tell us one more time.
Refresh them.
Yes.
Thanks for having me
we
on.
Need a,
I know
we,
our time is short
yes.
today, so I'll be brief. Anyone that wants to know more about me can go to my website at jennifercarroll.com. That's J-E-N-N-I-F-E-R. CARROLL.com, former lieutenant governor of the great state of Florida. I was also a state representative. I was a business owner and a retired military Navy lieutenant commander and a child that was born in Trinidad, West Indies, migrated to the United States at the age of 8, and adopted this country as my country.
Right, but isn't it wonderful when you say you were born in Trinidad and Tobago, and right away we think about our pledge, when, you know, we grew up with having such respect for each other and respecting those in authority and respecting people that show us the way. And it feels good to bring that respect here to the United States and incorporate it in our lives as well.
Well, our values, as our family values, our religious values, and as we're seeing a lot of the destruction that's going on today for supposedly a cause, I don't know since when destruction and terror is a as a solution to situations that are ailing and plaguing our society. And those values of religious values and our faith and our family values need to come into play so that when we see people doing wrong, we pull them aside and straighten them out. And we're assuming that everybody has a good home and has good role models to get them and keep them on track, but many times people don't. So when you see individuals not behaving themselves and not doing the things that we should expect as our mores and norms in our society, it's up to those that know better to pull them up and straighten them out.
Right. So how do we get people, Jennifer, my friend, and gosh, I learned so much from you, how do we get people on both sides, the left and the right, to reject extremism on both sides and move forward with a path for peace and communication and listening? How do we do that?
Here's a problem that I have. For many years, every time we have situations that have bubbled up, like we're seeing today with perceived racism or discrimination and so forth, it always comes down to we have to have a conversation. We have to talk. Well, how many times are you going to talk? We need to put things in action. And the way you bring things about in action is those leaders or people in a community that are impacted or are seeing these particular situations to bring forward solutions in a democratic way, in a respectable and conversational way where the policymakers can put something to paper and also the enforcers can have the tools necessary to enforce these policies. What we've seen throughout is that the lawmakers will hurry up and throw a bill out there or throw money at something and then it's not enforced on the back end. So you still have the same situation. Problem that's occurring, you just have covered it up with money and empathy to say we've done something about it. For example, the situation that we're seeing that occurred with the officer that placed his knee on George Floyd's neck, that was not standard procedure in the department. He has two rookies with him that they're worried about. If I squeal on this guy, I'm going to lose my job, and I just got on the force, and I have my family to take care of, and I'm not going to go up against this guy who's been on the force for 18, 19 years, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut. Well, that culture of secrecy in law enforcement with our lawyers and it just goes on in many of our institutions.
Yes,
have to go away.
Right, and it's almost like this cop went rogue, and the other two decided, boy, I'm thinking health insurance, car payments, I'm thinking my mortgage. If I say something, I might not have this job. But, I mean, when does it stop that good people say enough is enough? Mm-hmm.
Well, good people in law enforcement need to step up. You see, the culture of secrecy in these institutions is that if I speak up, I'm blackballed. I'm the one that squealed. I'm the rat. So therefore, the other cops are not going to have me inclusive in the organization. So from the top down, that culture has to change. So from the top law enforcement officer have to put the hammer down and say, this is not going to happen in my department. I encourage everybody that you see wrongdoing, wrong cops, that we have to I encourage you to call them out, as well as the police unions. They cannot cover up for cops that this guy had 18 infractions against him, 18 internal investigations of citizen complaints. At what point do they say that we pull this guy off the street or get him off the force? 18 complaints? There must be some legitimacy there, but nothing happened to him. And that happens pervasively throughout the country when they turn a blind eye to situations that they know are wrong or people that are doing wrong. How many times even in corporate America we see a boss that's constantly putting down people or harassing people and
or discrimination
because they don't want to lose their job.
Or unconscious bias. We've seen that, right? We've seen it, we live it. A lot of us, I have to be honest, I've been in situations where I'll say, well, should I say something? But then somebody else would say, well, you know what? Don't get involved. And so you start thinking, well, if I say something, they say if you see something, say something. But oftentimes you say it and you end up getting reprimanded, mm-hmm. not the person, the wrongdoer.
We see that with whistleblowers. Even though they have a whistleblower protection, when people call out injustices and things that are being wrong in an organization or an institution, they're the ones that's blackballed. And that's why many people don't speak up, because they have a family to feed. They have a career that they want to protect. And not everyone has the financial ability to say, I don't care about this job. I'm going to speak up and say what's right and do what's right for the betterment of those that may come after me. And in the military, I've had situations like that, that as I rose in rank, I had more authority to speak up and out against injustices that were occurring. But I did that when I had the strength to do so.
I was
and
just going to say,
not everyone have the strength to do so.
Right? Isn't it wonderful when you get to that place in life where you find your voice? And you're
mm-hmm.
able to
and your
speak
and your
from yeah, you're yeah. able to speak from your heart and have the courage to say, I'm gonna say it because it's a right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Right?
And not everybody is in that can be in that stage in life and or that strength in life. And I encourage those to look at this moment that we're now and see the injustice that was done to George Floyd and say, if you're in a situation where you know you have rogue actors and bad actors, I don't care if you're in corporate America, law enforcement, in the legal penal system, speak up and speak out. And the community at large should be backing those individuals that have the strength to speak out, because they will need the community support to either help them keep their job or to start a GoFundMe account to help them financially if they happen to lose their job.
Or to vote.
Yeah.
We see this with politicians as well, that people mm-hmm. tell you they're fighting for social causes and they want everyone to have a job and they want people to live a dignified life and have affordable housing and everything else. But then they get to Tallahassee or whichever capital they're in, and it's all party line. I think
yeah.
at some point,
or they get swayed by lobbyists.
Right.
One way
at
or another.
Some point, yeah. you have to say, I'm going to do the right thing, even in politics. Am I correct?
You are correct, and then you end up like me.
Yeah.
Booted
well, and,
out.
And to your point, but you were
standing
booted.
Standing with the status quo, you're standing alone.
Well,
but you know what? The conviction of doing that is worth it.
Yes.
Well, you make all of us stand up and do what's right, because you did what's right, and you're still doing what's right. You just started a GoFundMe account for the people whose businesses were destroyed and they have nowhere to work anymore, and their employees are holding their heads. So tell our listeners, my friend Jennifer Carroll, former lieutenant governor for the state of Florida, tell our listeners what you're doing to help the community with the GoFundMe account.
Well, thank you so much for bringing that up. The GoFundMe account is called the Riot Business Relief Fund. It's organized by me, Jennifer Carroll. It's Riot Business Relief Fund. And I started this GoFundMe because there were a number of black businesses, black-owned businesses in this riot that, through no fault of their own, were negatively impacted. These were business owners that took their life savings to open up a store, start a business in their community, enable to hire people in their community, and now for the inventory that they had in their stores are all gone. For the employees that they hired, they can no longer have employees because they don't have a job for them. For not having insurance to cover their losses, now they're stuck. If they took out a loan to open the business or took out a loan to buy that inventory, now they have to still pay that loan, although they have nothing. So the GoFundMe account is established to help these business owners to get their supplies to restart and kickstart their business. It's also coming with a business development component that I'm going to be partnering with a business organization to give these business owners an educated analysis of their business model and to help them really get on a stronger footing than they were before, as opposed to just giving the money. They come with a literacy component to help them grow their business and be more productive than they were before. This will help our economy strengthen. This will help the communities be strengthened, because the looters and the vandals, they went into these communities, they destroyed the grocery stores, they destroyed the drug stores, they destroyed the essential things that people in the community really needed to have a good, sustainable, economic, and viable engine. And what we're trying to do with the Riot Business Relief Fund is to provide resources to these business owners that didn't have insurance, that used their last bit of savings to start and open their business, to get them back on their feet again so their communities can grow and prosper.
Right. And you know what's sad is when the people are that angry and they're burning down their convenience store or their pharmacies, they're not understanding that some people in that community can't walk. They don't have a car. That's their pharmacy at the end of the road right there. And then on the other hand, you have politicians who are saying, well, we need to invest in the communities. This is the time of reckoning. This is when we need reforms. But at some point, they're going to have to sit down with the people who burned and looted and destroyed those places and say, listen, if you want investments and you want us to come in, you have to do your part. You have to be prepared to work and build these communities along with the people that you, Jennifer, are trying to help.
Absolutely. And these businesses cannot go to the bank, the big banks, and get a loan. Access to capital is very difficult for minority business owners to get to even start or expand their businesses. And that's why this Riot Business Relief Fund is so important to help and assist these business owners to get back on their feet. It's not going to come as a freebie. I believe that any business organization needs help to also look at their structure, their infrastructure, their business plan, and have a better a solution in moving forward as to if another COVID happened, how do you diversify your business or pivot your business to come with the order of the day to make sure that your business stays afloat rather than closing the doors and not have business operation for a while. And that happened to many small and medium-sized businesses. They could not pivot to make mask or to make hand sanitizer or to make the things that were needed in the order of the day.
Or to be able
and
to
so
sell online.
This business development will help these businesses in doing so.
And these people were hit double. They had the COVID-19 and now they had the rioters.
Exactly.
But give us the GoFundMe one more time and give us your website too so people could still go and buy your book and read all about you and what a positive person you are, and to uplift and motivate so many of us all over the world, whether we were born in Trinidad or here in the United States, you are a force, my friend, to be reckoned with yourself.
Well, thank you so much. As I mentioned before, my website is jennifercarroll.com, and the GoFundMe name of the fund is Riot Business Relief Fund, organized by Jennifer Carroll. Thank you so much for having me on today, and be blessed, and I hope your listeners are staying safe.
Thank you, and I'm going to have you back on later on to tell us how these businesses are thriving, and maybe you could bring one of the business owners on, too.
Absolutely. That's a plan.
All right.
Awesome. Once again, Sita, we're going to take a quick little station break and listen to one of our sponsors, and then we'll be right back with Keith Beauchamp.
Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture is a family-owned furniture dealer featuring the best and most affordable brands. They offer all servicing for free. Delivery, setup, and home, removal of old furniture, and warranty. Work with a reputable and experienced local business as they strive for excellence with their customers. Scotty's been in the mattress and furniture business for 32 years. You can shop online, call, or stop into the showroom to place an order. They are conveniently located inside the Merritt Square Mall and service all of Brevard County in Central Florida. Super savings sale happening now. That's Cloud9 Mattress and Furniture, 321-459-2473. Visit them on the web at Cloud9, that's Cloud9, furniture.com. Again, 321-459-2473 for Cloud9. Mattress and furniture. When you need medical care and need it fast, MedFast Urgent Care is faster and less expensive than emergency rooms. MedFast is open 7 days a week, now with 8 locations serving Brevard County. So if you have an emergency, need a physical, or when your doctor is unavailable, with 8 locations, MedFast offers top quality care that is close by and the number is easy to remember. That is 321-MEDFAST. You just call 321-MEDFAST. No one wants to wait in an emergency room for hours and get even sicker when you get the high bill. What you want is medical care fast. That's why you call MEDFAST, where most patients are seen and treated in less than an hour. MEDFAST Urgent Care opens 7 days a week with the convenience of 8 locations serving Brevard County. So when you need medical care fast, call 321-MEDFAST. MedFast.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Sita Biggie on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Ellen Little is here. Paul is running our board. We just had a really nice conversation with our good friend Jennifer Carroll, who was the former lieutenant governor for the state of Florida.
Well, still is the former lieutenant.
She still is, and she is a Trini like myself, and we have a lot in common. Yeah. She's a Republican, I'm a Democrat, but boy, we hit it off. Because you could find common ground, Ellen. Oh. You really can. Okay. And so my third person calling in today is somebody that I admire very much. I follow him on Facebook. My friend Keith is a filmmaker based in Brooklyn, Miss Ellen, and yes. You could take it from there. Ellen is dying to say who you are, Keith, so I'm going to let her say it.
Okay, great.
Keith investigated the murder of Emmett Till 50 years after Till's death in 1955. He created a documentary about it, and I believe that's the last time that we spoke, right, with Keith? Was about that documentary and so forth. He was born in Fort Gordon, Augusta, Georgia. He's got news and documentary Emmy Awards for Best Documentary, and we're just so happy to have you on the show today.
Right, and you know, Keith, I ask you to come on today because you are a very level-headed person, and you look at everything, and then you write up your Facebook post, and it's usually things that stirs people's heart towards peace, nonviolence, and what can we do to make changes. We all want to see changes from racism. We want to see the systemic changes made. Well, so talk to us a little bit about what you are doing right now in reference to these protesters and what has happened with the death of George Floyd, 8.46 seconds.
Okay. Well, thank you both for having me. It's wonderful to come back on your show and to vent a little bit about the real world, right?
Yes, because this happened
in
to
our
you.
Lives. And so it's, you know, for me right now, to be honest, I'm still trying to process everything that has happened. I know that, you know, in recent weeks and days, and so many people are talking about these protests, and of course, rightfully so, the death of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and of course, Ahmaud Arbery out of Georgia. I mean, it's been a crazy 100 days, and I say 100 days is because 100 days ago is when this whole coronavirus restrictions and everything, you know, has come into play, and it's changed our world in many ways. And so I'm still at a phase of really trying to process all that is going on, because many of you, your listeners, if you know my work, this is something I've been doing since I was 22 years old. I'm actually going to be 49 in July. And so this is over half of my life I've been fighting to speak about the injustices that not just African Americans face, but every common American in general. Because I think it's important to understand that injustice affects us all. But in particular, now we're dealing with this ongoing, I hate to say slaughter, but this ongoing death of young black men or black men, black women in general, at the hands of police. And of course, this is something that is not new. This is something that is generational, and it may take generations for us to fix. But now that the public, black and white, all races have come together to acknowledge the atrocities that have been put on people of color in this country, it is time to teach.
Right, and you know, and we're watching the protest all over the world, in Germany, in Britain, in France. In France, activists in Paris wearing black clothing and face masks took a knee and held up signs and said, "I can't breathe. We are George Floyd, and racism chokes us." But also, what I find is this, that the protest almost is against the wrongdoings of the past. People are trying to make it right in the 21st century.
I'm glad you say that, because the uprising, if you want to, I shouldn't call it uprising, but the protests, the national, international protests that you're seeing, is not just because of the death of George Floyd. George Floyd is a microcosm to an overall systemic problem that we've been dealing with for generations and generations. What's interesting is when you hear George Floyd's name, Breonna Taylor's name, Ahmaud Arbery's name, you always metaphorically hear Emmett Till's name coming into fruition.
Yes, and then we think of you. Every time we hear his name, I think of you.
Yes, thank you. But, you know, that's what it's about. I mean, this is a continuous struggle that this country and many countries have when it comes to race in their communities abroad. And so this is something that we have to deal with. It's wonderful to see people acknowledge the problem now, and they're open to hear, to listen. But, you know, as a black man in America, I have to be honest, it's still a constant struggle for myself to even conceive what has happened is really happening.
Right, you because know, when the protest is over, you're still a black man in America hoping for change, hoping to see investments in communities, hoping to see communication, hoping to see that people actually pay attention to their
Absolutely.
Children, their families, and take opportunities. But those opportunities don't come to certain zip codes unless you actually fight for it through voting.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, voting is key here. But again, we're all in a situation at this moment where we're seeing all these protests happen. We're going to have to pause at a certain point and heal from what we've just been through. And then put in the work that needs to be done. Because again, as a black man, you know, standing before you, I really cried when I saw the marching around the world, because for so long, African Americans in this country, we have protested and marched just simply for people to understand that we're human beings, to look at us as a human being, especially as black men.
I think so what happened with this that was different, Keith Beauchamp, Ellen says to say your name correctly. You know, I think when George Floyd was under the policeman's knee and we were watching, and then all of a sudden he called out for his mom. That's when I broke down. I mean, I was upset like right along with it. You know, I was like, what the heck is happening here? And then when the man says his mama, I lost it. I couldn't stop crying, because that's what I do when I'm upset, even though my mother is gone. We all call for our mamas, and I think that affected you as well, didn't it?
Of course it affected me, probably a lot more than a lot of other people. I say that because, again, I've been doing this work since I was 22. I'm somewhat conditioned to receive what's happening and processing it in the right way. Of course, one of my great teachers was the late Mrs. Mamie Till Mobley, the mother of Emmett Till, my confidant, my friend, someone who sculpted me into this activist filmmaker that I've become. And, you know, just being able to sit with her and discuss these issues constantly have, I thought, prepared me for this moment. But when I saw, of course, the death of George Floyd and how the officer handled that situation, and how he had kneel on George Floyd's neck, the only thing it brought me back to was the story of Emmett Till and when I first saw that photograph when I was 10 years old. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of like jolted me back to my innocence, per se, where I could not really process what was happening. Because
so,
for so long, you know, even metaphorically, just to see a white man's knees kneeling on a black man's neck, I mean, it just threw me in a loop.
And it's so such a big challenge for so many families now. How do you explain, you know, for a black family, how do they explain that to their children? You know, how
you
do
know,
they?
That's a great question. That's a wonderful question, because I was actually being interviewed by New York Times the other day, and I I had to pause for a second because it is very difficult to see this happen in real time and being African American, having to process it, and not only process it, but talk about it.
Right.
There are some things that cannot be talked about or shouldn't be spoken. I mean, it just is. And we have to find our way to get around it. But I spoke with the reporter and I basically said, you know, it's a shame that in my day, growing up, my father taught me the black male code. And these are survivor codes that African-American males are taught at an early age to protect them and to show them how to navigate in a white-dominant society.
And one of those codes was how to act when you see a police officer, correct?
Exactly. And so, but now things have escalated to a point where there's generations of young black males, and I'm not sure if they're getting the same information, and I'm not putting this on the black community whatsoever, but all I'm saying is that we used to walk out of the house during the day and wonder which mask are we going to wear that day. Are we going to put our black mask on? Are we going to put the nice, friendly mask on to adapt to the surroundings that in which we're going into? And that's the battle of black people in general. But what I'm saying is it was a sad thing to have to talk about the black male code in my generation. Now there's a whole nother generation who has to adapt to the surroundings around them, and those same black male codes that was taught to me, once taught to me, has to be taught differently for this new generation.
The thing is, you had your dad, and he was able to guide you. Nowadays, we're seeing where, due to no fault of a lot of people's lives there, whether it's drugs, whether it's lack of a proper job, whether someone has a mental issue, the police officers are being called to take care of social issues. And these men are ending up in prison. And so they're not there for their children. So I'm saying, you know, like now with all that's going on with the protesting and the looting and the rioting, wouldn't it be wonderful for us to take some of that money that we have, that we're putting into law enforcement? We need our law enforcement officers, but take some of that money and put it into the communities so that the young child like you could have a dad to say, I'm waiting for you.
Sure.
Right. I'm guiding you, and I'm waiting for you at 5 o'clock. Come home to this house, but this is how you act. You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. But what I was trying to get out is the fact that it's a shame that I had to be taught the black male code growing up, and now there's another generation behind me that we have to be taught that, but taught it differently. And what I mean by differently is the onus would possibly be on the individual themselves, whether they're taught by their relatives, elders, or what have you. That is something that's just going to have to be a part of our DNA. And what I mean, again, what I mean by that is when we walk out into the world during the day, we're going to have to walk a little bit more on eggshells, in a sense. We can't afford to make any mistakes anymore, innocent mistakes.
So how do we fix it, Keith?
Cause of our lives.
We have a few minutes left, and how do we fix it so that the children? I mean, that is a lot of burden on a child.
Of course.
And especially if you think about a mixed race child as well, that doesn't know who to identify with.
It's Indian. It's us Indian, Asian Indian people with dark skin too, but I've always said you fix it through a communication, life experience, and education. But how do you think we fix it?
We all know we need police reform. That's one half of the battle. And I say one half of the battle is because the essence of what we're dealing with is race in America. We have not properly taught and got past race in America. So we could fix one half of the problem, or partial part of the problem, but it all boils down to us teaching race. And racism, I don't want to upset anybody, but to be real, racism will never end. That's just going to exist. Man is always going to have prejudice against someone. What we need to teach is tolerance, because tolerance is more attainable in getting than fighting the ill racism and think you can actually end it. we have to be tolerant about each other's differences and respect each other as human beings. And that's a start. It is not the answer, but it's just a start. And so I am praying that all that we're seeing today has energized this generation and even the generations before us and even our elders to really take a look at where we're, the way we're living in this world, and ask ourselves, do we want to continue to live this way? Do we continue want to, you know, live in a country where freedom and justice is not for all? Do we want to still live in an environment where it's unequal for Americans? I don't think so. Just going through this whole COVID-19 thing has brought many of us together as simple human beings, and that's the way we have to look at each other. Not by, you know, the social construct of race in America. We have to look at each other as human beings. And until we're able to do that, we're going to continue to fall in this line of marching and protesting. We're going to continue to fight these same social
and rioting, which none of us stand for. But, you know, you bring up a good point, because the conversations have to be at your own table, in your own home. Everything starts in the home. The foundation, in my mind, for racism also starts in some people's homes.
Yes, I totally agree. And I just hope that people are more open now to understand how this social construct of race in America is destroying us all.
Yeah. So and it's weird how the intolerance is amongst us as citizens, and not as much intolerance to our officials and even local officials. You know, we're not going, like I said, the protesting is certainly helping, I think, a little bit, I hope a little bit, but we really need to be much more forthcoming.
Well,
with
I think
that
people have to vote.
Absolutely,
people
no.
have to vote for know who their officials are at a local level, state level,
yep.
and congressional level.
Absolutely. I think we're one of the most politically conscious generations of our time, this generation.
Yes, absolutely.
And we do have the power to cause change in our own way. We need to vote the right people in and take the bad people out. And that's what we're going to have to do.
And that could be in either party. It doesn't. And you know
exactly.
what, Keith? That's not. I mean, we have bad Democrats, we have bad Republicans, but we also have people that can sit down and break bread together and say, hey, listen, I want to help your schools. I want to have some investments in your community. I want to help you. So give us your website. So if somebody wants to go on and look at your documentaries or learn a little bit about our friend Keith Beauchamp, they can learn about you.
Well, I don't have any websites active right now, but on social media, under my name, Keith Beauchamp, you could also, I know that, Investigation Discovery, my old, network has been running the Injustice Files again, one of my TV series. You're welcome to go on Investigation Discovery's website and look up Injustice Files and see some of my work there. The Untold Story of Emmett Lewis Till is on Amazon Prime, and those who don't have cable or have a subscription with
I'm
going
to have to
Prime.
Cut you off, Keith. I'm sorry, but I will post. I have all of this information. I will post it on our Facebook page.
Thank you, Keith.
Thank you so much for calling in. What a great conversation.
No,
what a great conversation.
He's awesome.
Thank you so much, Sita, for once again giving us some fantastic guests here on Viewpoint with Sita and Friends. Folks, tune in each and every Monday right here on 1510 WWBC at 1 p.m.